back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are positively into football season, but I don't know. We have this guy on. It's sports. Sometimes it's golf. Sometimes when we allow him, we just get in that political lane and we have a good time. All of our Baltimore Positive conversations brought to you by our friends at State Fair. And at some point, we may bring John Feinstein over to State Fair or El Guapo or the Beaumont and sit down because he calls games at UMBC and he lives in the corridor anyway. Don Moeller, you always request fine every quarter. It's kind of like a report card when he was my school teacher, John. Every quarter I have to call you and we have to do some sort of golf residue off of this little international thing we played last week.
Let me say for the record, Don, before you jump in, I ate at State Fair 2 weeks ago.
Oh.
Jim nice. Ferry took me there. I went to see UMBC practice, and we went and ate there afterwards.
I hope it was good.
It was good. It was good. I had a steak and onion sandwich. I don't like.
Oh, that's a good.
Like
that's
cheese,
a good sandwich.
So I had steak and onions,
chicken and waffles. That's all you
that's
need to
good,
know. Get the chicken and waffles.
A good sandwich there again.
I'm good with chicken and waffles.
One of our very very favorite guests, John. You have. I said to Nestor a couple of weeks ago. I said, "Hey man, come on, Ryder Cup's coming up. I don't even apologize anymore for being a couch potato for 3 days. I want to start. You've written about it. Let me see. I think your one book, The First Major, right, was 2016. That was inside the Ryder Cup. And all the way back in 93, even in A Good Walk Spoiled, that had a good portion of Ryder Cup. So you've
started at the Ryder Cup. You're right.
Started at the Ryder. I mean, you've been a Ryder Cup guy for many, many years. My thought is, and you'll probably blow holes in it, but I think that Friday, from the foursomes in the morning to the better ball in the afternoon, alternate shot and then better ball, I think that Friday for me is akin to the Thursday in the first weekend of the NCAA. I mean, because I have a set, you don't know what's going to happen. I feel the tension and the crowd. You can almost see it on the player's face. Am I right about that? And if so, talk a little bit about that first day and Ryder Cup.
Well, let me say, first of all, Don, I think the Ryder Cup's the best event in golf. I've felt it ever since I went to it for the first time in 1993 at the Belfry when I was researching A Good Walk Spoiled. The tension's totally different. Than at a major. And I love the majors, as you know. But because it's a team event, because you're representing your country, because you're playing for your teammates, for the captains, for the wives, everybody, the tension's unreal. And Davis Love told me a story. 93 was his first Ryder Cup. And Tom Watson was the captain. And the night before the matches began, there were four rookies on that team: Davis, John Cook, Chip Beck, and Lee Jansen. Lee Jansen had won a U.S. Open at that point. And the night before, Watson said to the four rookies, "This is the only event in golf in which your legs will shake on the first tee." And Davis thought, what is he talking about? I played in the four majors. I've been on the first tee at the Masters. What's he talking about? And the next morning was foursomes, alternate shot, as you said. And he was playing with Tom Kite. And they had decided, because of the way the golf course was laid out, that Davis would tee off on the odd holes. So they're walking toward the first tee. And Davis realized two things. One, number one is an odd number. And number two, his legs were shaking, just as Watson had predicted. And he turned to Kite and he said, "Tom, why don't you take the odd hole?" Odd holes. And Kite said, "Davis, you'll be okay." And he was. But every player I interviewed for the first major said that, who had played in a Ryder Cup at that point, said the same thing about the first tee, how it is the most terrifying shot you will ever hit in your life as a golfer. And these are guys who have hit all sorts of important shots. And in fact, Brant Snedeker told me that the first time he played, he was paired with Jim Furyk, who had already played in like seven Ryder Cups. And on the first tee, Furyk hit a snap hook. And Brant said he didn't think, "Oh God, where am I going to be to hit that second shot?" He thought, "Well, if Jim Furyk can hit a snap hook on the first tee, it's okay that I'm so nervous.
I'm all right now."
So It is unique. It's like it's like no other event in golf. And the tension is unbelievable. Now, I'll be honest, the last four Ryder Cups have been a little disappointing because they've all been routes. We haven't had a really close Ryder Cup since 2012 at Medina when Europe came from 10-6 down to win on the last day. Europe has won easily in Europe, and the Americans have won easily in the U.S., and that's a pattern I hope will change beginning in Italy in 2 years.
Yeah, I mean, this one was over early, and it's interesting, John. You had tweeted a couple of days before the Cup. You said Americans had there are 10 top 10 players in this Ryder Cup. America has 8 of them. Something right. to the effect of chalk doesn't always hold, but they have 8. Well, chalk held, right?
Chalk held, yes. And you know, Don, often it doesn't. I mean, particularly on the European side, where quote-unquote unknowns have played heroic roles for Europe. Do you even remember a guy like Peter Baker,
right.
who was 3-1 in 1993, and Paul McGinley getting the last two key points Saturday and Sunday in 2006. And it goes on and on like that. But this time, I got to give Steve Stricker credit, because I was one of those guys who said he needed a Phil Mickelson in the room. He needed a Patrick Reed in the room. Mickelson, for all his experience, Reed, because he had such a good Ryder Cup record. Well, he passed on both of them.
And but you wrote, John, in your defense, and you're being very modest, you did write afterward, even though you had said that ahead of time, he got Mickelson in the room. He just got him there as a captain.
He got him there as a vice captain, which is obviously a different role. But the point being, I love Steve Stricker, one of my favorite guys, and he got it right. He got the right guys. He got the right pairings. Europe was, you know, Europe's age showed 4 guys over 40. And the only one who played well was Sergio Garcia. And the other thing, the one thing people do forget, Don, and I know you read that column I wrote, is the importance of home course. And it's not so much because of the crowds. I mean, the crowds are helpful, I would think. But the real advantage is the course setup. Because the U.S. captain, or when it's in Europe, the European captain, the home captain controls the setup of the golf course. And that means how wide the fairways are, how high the rough is, how fast the greens are, where the tee boxes are. And the home team obviously controls the choice of venue. I'm not a huge Whistling Straits fan. Whistling Straits shows great on TV. Because
boy, does it ever.
you look like you're in Scotland, right? Literally, right?
It's a gorgeous golf course. But it played this weekend because of the course setup. It played like a Bob Hope course. I mean, guys were making 7 and 8 birdies around. There were drivable par fours all over the place. And that's what the U.S. wants. When the U.S. won at Hazeltine, similar setup, you remember everybody said, aha, we figured it out. The Ryder Cup committee got it right, all that stuff. And then they went to Paris, where the fairways were narrower, the rough was thicker, the greens were slower, and boom, the Europeans win 17.5, 11.5.
So, well, you're getting beat up a little bit, important. John. You're getting beat up a little bit, John, on your Twitter feed. And you wrote the article right away. You came out in Golf Digest. You said, Everybody's going, it's the Americans' time. All these young kids, we're going to dominate for the next two decades. And there's old Obi-Wan John Feinstein. He says, not so fast. Why not so fast, John?
Well, because of what I just cited, it's worth remembering, Don, that the home team has now won 10 of the last 12 Ryder Cups.
Well, they manipulate the course. They manipulate the course, literally. Right?
Exactly. That's an important factor, Nestor. And the TV guys aren't going to bring it up because they want to go USA, USA. And the fact that they brought it up in Paris when the U.S. was getting killed. But the fact is, it makes a big difference. It would have been 11 out of 12 if the U.S. hadn't choked on Sunday at Medina. So, my friend Steve Sands went on my friend Tony Kornheiser's podcast and said, the U.S. can win five or six in a row now. Well, maybe they will. I mean, maybe they will. But history says they won't. I mean, history says that in Italy, it's going to be a lot tougher in Italy. In 2 years. That doesn't mean the U.S. won't win, but it's worth remembering the U.S. hasn't won in Europe since 1993.
Yeah.
that Tom Watson team that I referenced. And so, you know, everybody's going, oh, now we figured it out. You know, Phil Mickelson said to me after 2016, when the U.S. won at Hazeltine easily, and I talked to him afterwards for the book, he said, we've cracked the code. We figured out how the Europeans have been beating us all these years. Well, Phil went 0-2 in Paris and the U.S. got crushed. So there's no code to crack. It's just a matter of time and circumstance every 2 years.
I don't think there I think that's a great point. There's no code. And I don't think you can underestimate the thousands of European fans who will be there next time singing ole, 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 ole. And,
right.
You know, chanting.
I missed them this
time. Of course,
time.
We didn't have that. I thought that we missed that a little bit. I thought at Whistling Straits, the European fans being there. I want you to talk a little bit, John. Neat that you said Strick's one of your favorite guys, because looking back, I thought people, I think sometimes don't understand how important this camaraderie is. And it sounds so weird, right? When you're talking about professional athletes and I think Koepka said the truth out loud. People didn't like it, but for a lot of these guys, and you've written, Tiger was uncomfortable early in his career
before he was 1-7 in Ryder Cups as a player.
Right.
His team.
And then all of a sudden he found religion, and this new Tiger, you know, who's sending guys text and they're right. going to talk to him ahead of time. But I thought it didn't seem phony to me. And that's why I want you to burst my bubble. It seems to me that they really did create a sense of team. And I'm going to jump on one of our favorite topics.
He buys all the PR, John. Just
well,
so you know.
I'm going to ask John. Wait a minute. Because John knows I've got a grandson that runs around, 10-year-old, with the DeChambeau hat and Schlesinger hat, and he won't take it off. I think he sleeps in it, and he swings as hard as DeChambeau does. It looked to me like the pairing of Scottie Scheffler and Bryson DeChambeau was really almost a stroke of genius on Stricker's part to figure out who's going to play with this guy who sometimes can be a challenge. It react to that and Stricker and how he handled that.
Well, first of all, challenge is a nice euphemism for Brandel. Bryson, excuse me. Freudian slip. I love Brandel Chamblee. I agree with you that Steve did a great job. I think he sat down with DeChambeau and Koepka and said, look, for 1 week, just cool it. You can go back to hating each other afterwards. And it reminded me of something Ian Poulter said to me when I was doing the book, because we were talking about the European camaraderie versus the lack of camaraderie in the American team room, often caused by the friction between Tiger and Mickelson, who didn't like each other until they decided they could make money by being BFFs. But what Poulter said to me was, look, we have differences. We have guys who don't get along, just like the Americans do. He said, the difference is for 1 week, we take all of those issues, we leave them outside the team room door. And then when the week is over, we all go back to hating Monty, who was one of the great Ryder Cup players,
right.
Colin Montgomery. But that Stricker was able to do that. He was anybody who thinks those hugs were real on Sunday is I'd like to sell some oceanfront land in Oklahoma.
Was it real in the moment though, John?
No, it wasn't. No? It wasn't, Don. It was, remember, you know, it was like, they knew the cameras were rolling. And, you know, it reminded me of 1986 when Daryl Strawberry was whining about being pinch hit for in game six when he, you know, couldn't possibly get a hit. Then in game seven, when the Mets had a big lead, and he complained about Davey Johnson taking him out. And in game seven, when the Mets had a big lead, he hits a home run. And as he crosses the plate, Ray Knight says to him, be a man and go shake hands with Davey. And Daryl did it. But he did it because Ray Knight told him to do it.
Right.
Koepka, well, and you think Koepka and DeChambeau are going to be buddies? They're two entirely different people.
But okay, well, and yes, they are, and I'm
that's
not sure.
Fine.
And I think
they were teammates for a week, and it all worked
for a week. My 14-year-old John.
But as the non-golf guy, I would say, and John, the straw that stirs the drink, and you know all the media we do here. golf is boring as hell to most of us, that the fact that there's a bad guy and someone willing to play the WWE role of being the, like that, that's good for golf. I thought that when I was at the BMW a couple weeks ago, I thought for a novice like me to just be interested, to have a guy that everybody hates makes a better party. For television, it's always true
in sports, Nestor, whether it's a sport that's a niche sport, which golf is to some degree, or it's people hating the Yankees or people hating the Patriots.
But Don doesn't really want DeChambeau and Kepka. Your grandkid doesn't want
conflict. I would have seen them play together and get in a fist fight on a 12th fairway or something. I would have loved that.
14th, here's what I want you.
That would have been more authentic than the hug.
I want John.
Right, exactly right. Because that's not a real deal.
I want John to do this for me because my 14-year-old, who's not the golfer, my 10-year-old's the golfer, but my 14-year-old, who's an athlete and a sports fan and was really into the Ryder Cup, said to me at one point, "Pop, why does everybody hate DeChambeau?" And I said, and I got a good friend, John, who called when DeChambeau drove number one on Sunday. And the guy's on the phone with me, and he's rooting for him to not drive the green. And I said, "What is wrong with you? Why do you not want him? I hate him." And I say to him, "Why do you hate DeChambeau?" Mm-hmm. And I don't know him, so I can't hate him. I mean, I do draw a line. For me to not like somebody, I have to know them a little bit. What is it about him? You and I have talked a little bit before. What do I say to my grandson is, why does he rub everybody the wrong way, John?
Okay, well, first of all, he is certainly entertaining to watch, especially since he became Popeye and started hitting the ball hundreds of miles. And there's no question about that. But here's kind of a little list of the things a lot of people don't like about him, and I would include myself on that list. I don't hate him, but I do know him a little bit. Number one, he's the slowest player on the PGA Tour, and it's infuriating to watch when he pulls out that greens book for a 2-foot putt. And fortunately, the greens books, I think, are going the way of the Edsel at the end of this year. And that should help speed up play. That's number one. Number two, he's a whiner. He's always complaining. It's never his fault. You know, I mean, he literally blames the golf ball when it goes offline. You know, how can it go over there? Well, because you hit it over there, Bryce.
Right. We can help you with that. Yeah.
Number three, he doesn't tell the truth. I mean, you know, he said he didn't get vaccinated for COVID because he was trying to save the vaccine for someone else. Come on. Nobody's that stupid to buy that story. And then remember on Friday, I don't know if you guys were out there at Caves Valley when he had a 6-foot putt to shoot 60 and he dead pulled it.
Right.
Dead pulled it. You know, choked. It happens. It happens to everybody.
Sure.
But afterwards, he refused to speak to the print media because he was still mad at the print media for reporting what he said about COVID, but he did do a TV interview because he was avoiding being fined. And in the TV interview, he said, I hit the putt just like I wanted to. I misread it. No, he didn't. I mean, you don't have to be a golf expert to see that putt was left all the way. So he does all these things. And the first time I met him, interestingly, was his rookie year on tour, 2016. And I was waiting for my car at Hartford. And he walked up and introduced himself to me, which impressed me, to be honest, you know, that a player would go out of his way to introduce himself to a reporter. But he said, "You need to write a column about these rules officials because they're picking on me. I've gotten 10 slow play warnings, and I've only been on the tour since April." This is in August. And first of all, I know the rules guys, and they bend over backwards to not give guys warnings, number one. And number two, I'd seen him play. And I looked at him and I said, "Bryson, all due respect, you're slow."
Yeah.
And he literally turned around and walked away from me. So, and he has this attitude in the locker room. This is strictly from players that he's better than they are. Well, he's a very good player. He's one of the best players in the world. But most, you know, Rory McIlroy is better for years, was better than everybody and never acted that way. Tiger did. Phil didn't early on a little bit, but he grew out of it. Maybe Bryson will grow out of that, because right now, if you took a vote in the locker room, Koepka versus DeChambeau, I'm telling you, it would be unanimous for Koepka.
Yeah. Oh, no, I think there is no doubt. And before we leave the Ryder Cup and get to your latest book, You know, there are so many wild moments when you look back, John, and I'm sure you were there in 99, the Brookline, the Justin putt, and everybody running and tackling and the foul still waiting. But one of the things I always remember about that day was the what I always called were the ugliest shirts ever put on a golf course.
They were.
By a U.S. team. And then Justin shows up this weekend wearing the shirt, and I never knew. I mean, you knew it. The shirts were actually the pictures of all the winning Ryder Cup teams.
Yeah. Yeah, they were. I can't remember who designed them. They were specially designed for that day. And it just happened.
If it was ugly, it might have been Under Armour, but that was before their time, I think.
I mean, they were ugly. Nestor, you're not a golfer. You got to go back and Google these shirts.
I've seen some of the Maryland outfits, John. So, you know.
And well, that's true, too.
These are bad shirts.
Especially like the night they came out dressed in yellow and looked like a bunch of French fries.
Well, two guys I know you're big fans of because we've talked about it before. And boy, did I feel for both of them over the weekend, although I thought, again, Jordan showed who he is on the 18th hole the other day when he went good with Fleetwood, right? Didn't want Fleetwood to – no reason for Fleetwood to miss that putt. How do you – you can't explain it. I'm going to ask you to opine on it, I guess. Jordan being winless in singles. That just makes no sense to me, John.
And believe me, Don, it bothers him. I mean, I talked to him after he lost to Stenson in 2016. Then he lost again. Sunday was the first time he didn't lose in singles. And I can't give you a specific reason. He's played good players. I mean, Stenson was a great player when he lost to him in 2016. Some guys, you know, Poulter's never lost a singles match. And who's a better player overall? Jordan Spieth is a better player than Ian Poulter. He's won three majors. But Poulter is, I think, now 6-0-1 in singles, and Jordan's 0-3-1. So it's one of those things that's not really explicable. I'm glad Jordan ended up on the team because, you know, if not for COVID, he wouldn't have been on the team last
right.
year.
But yeah, I was glad
made this year got him on the team. So that part's good.
And of course, he hits a chip on Friday that'll be shown to my great grandchildren. Right, ball went 300 yards. In the air.
Well, the great part was that it ended up 5 feet from the pin, and he almost fell in the water.
And then was it Thomas missed the putt? Whoever it was missed.
Yeah,
the
Justin
putt,
missed
right?
the putt.
Justin missed the putt.
You know what's funny, Don? You were talking about being riveted. I got so bored Sunday, and I'm glad I did. I turned over to the Ravens game.
Well, I was going back and forth.
Now we're
talking about an ending. Wow.
Yeah, I was going back and forth before we leave the cup. You got to talk about Sergio because I'm sure people out there. I mean, I find that guy four decades of Ryder Cups and still
joyous. His first one, yeah.
And still joyous. Tell us about Sergio.
You know, again, I spent a lot of time with Sergio when I was researching the Ryder Cup book, and interestingly, you might remember in 2010 he had a real slump. He was playing horribly, and really had. I don't want to say lost interest, but he certainly lost his enjoyment of golf. And he decided after the PGA Championship, when he missed the cut, to take a break. He wasn't going to play for the rest of the year. Colin Montgomery asked him to come to the Ryder Cup in Wales as a vice captain. And he told me being a vice captain and being there and not playing made him hungry to play again, made him want to get good again, made him want to work at his game again, made him want to come back to being the player he'd been. And he said that was the turning point in his career. And of course, eventually he won the Masters, and that will put him in the Hall of Fame eventually, that and his Ryder Cup record. And the thing you've got to understand about Sergio is I think people miss this because sometimes he puts his foot in his mouth and makes mistakes. He loves people. He just loves being around people.
It comes across.
He's a great, he's a really good guy. He's one of my favorites out there, as you mentioned. And he's honest. That sometimes gets him in trouble, the same way Rory gets in trouble sometimes by being honest. But I'll take that a million times over Bryson DeChambeau listing his sponsors when he's asked about winning a tournament.
John, before we leave golf, I want to mention the BMW and Case, because you mentioned it. I went out. It was the first time I was on a golf course during a tournament since 1987 or 88, whenever Jack Gibbons sent me up to cover the women's tournament in New Jersey. So you could figure that out in advance of Annika Sorenstam. So we're going back 3.5 decades here. But I went out on the Sunday. It was at the end of my Maryland Crab Cake tour. I didn't think I was going to make it there. I came home a day early, and I went out and spent the whole day Sunday. And you mentioned Sergio Garcia. He's probably the first guy I saw when I showed up and saw fans carting around. It was a wonderful event. I feel like I've done everything. 30 years of doing sports radio here, almost 40 years in media. I've been to boxing matches and triathlons and done all of these things, Preaknesses and derbies and all these things. Being at a golf tournament 20 minutes from home where they bring in the golf tournament, you know, like it looked like the hills of Caves Valley were built with those stanchions in there. Like it's unbelievable to me in the modern era how transportable these tournaments are. And to those of you who do this for a living and run around and love it and walk the courses and do all that for 4 days every weekend covering it, it was a fascinating flyby for me to have a press credential for a golf tournament that I've never really done before. So it was very new to me and very familiar from TV and seeing it in that way, but really cool. I'm not a golf guy, you know that, but right. I felt some real pride as I wear a Maryland shirt in having this here and thinking, my God, why haven't we been on this circuit every 10 or 15 years? So this is the third or fourth time I've done this, really the first time in my lifetime kind of sort of that this was available.
Yeah, well, the Senior U.S. Open was at Caves a couple times, Nestor. But you're right. Correct. This is the first time the PGA Tour went there. And they'll go back. They'll go back because Caves is a terrific golf course. It's set up really well. It was a little bit of a perfect storm because it was wet and there wasn't a lot of wind. So the scoring was lower than I think they wanted. But Dennis Satisher, who's been the pro there since the course opened in 1990, did a fantastic job with his staff. And I say that, A, because it's true, and B, because Dennis is a longtime friend. But
his kid interned at WNST, so I'm all good with the Satisher.
There you go. The Evans Scholarship Fund, which gets caddy scholarships to college and has done it for years and years out of Chicago, they kind of ran the Western Open. This event was once the Western mm-hmm. Open and then became a part of the PGA Tour playoffs. And they came in and really put things together in Baltimore. And they did a fantastic job with everything, with the organization, with the logistics. The hardest thing about a golf tournament is the logistics because it's so spread out. And usually a place like Caves, there are no main roads to get there. You got to take two lane roads to get to the
golf course. None of these golf courses were laid out for human beings. They were laid out for golfers, right?
Like, right. And
having galleries is not part of that. That
thousands of people would show up to watch golf. So they did a great job. Dennis and his staff did a great job. And we were lucky that we got an amazing finish with that playoff between Cantlay and DeChambeau.
Well, John, you've watched, and this will be the last thing on golf. I want to move on to your new book. And I would point out that even though TV, like, say, Baltimore, they did occasionally say Owings Mills, the tournament was in Baltimore County. And it was County Executive Wyshewski and his team that did a phenomenal job in bringing all the infrastructure and getting that thing ready to go. But you've watched golf a long time. Have you ever, without hyperbole, seen a guy started on 16, I guess, make six straight putts that he had to make like Cantlay did?
Well,
I've never seen anything like
to,
that, John.
Don, the only thing I can compare it to is you might remember back in 2012 at the Ryder Cup at Medina, the U.S. had a 10-4 lead Saturday afternoon. And the last match of the day was Poulter and McIlroy against, I want to say, Reed and maybe Spieth. And Poulter birdied the last five holes. And Roy likes to point out he birdied 13 and then Poulter birdied the last five. But that, and they won one up. And that match was the turning point of that Ryder Cup because 10-6 is a hell of a lot different than 11-5. And Poulter kept, and he wasn't like making tap-ins, he was making 20 footers. And guys have told me they've never seen a performance quite like that. But what Cantlay did was extraordinary. Now, the flip side is DeChambeau had like a couple six-footers right. to win and miss them.
Right, so right.
That helped too.
Goes both ways. But I thought I've never seen a guy every time I make it or lose, and he kept making it.
That's why they started calling him Patty Ice.
Yeah, it was Patty Ice. So, John, you are about to go, and I'm telling folks, get on Amazon, pre-order, or go to your bookstore. November the 16th comes out because you are going where few dare to tread. You're going to look at race in sports with a new book called Raise a Fist, Take a Knee. First of all, the inspiration for it, and give us sort of a preview.
Well, the inspiration for it goes way back, Don. I mean, I've been around race in sports since I played junior high school basketball, when I was the only white kid on my team, and my nickname was White Boy. And it was an affectionate nickname, but I was the only white guy on the team.
You're the original White Shadow.
There you go. I couldn't jump, though. I could shoot, but I couldn't jump. But
they made a movie about that.
I know that. I'm well aware of that. It wasn't a bad movie either. As a reporter through the years, I've seen it up close. And really, though, Don, the inspiration goes back to the national anthem protest in 2017. And you guys were in the stadium in Baltimore. There was one particular Sunday, I think it was against the Steelers. It was the week after Donald Trump's rant against the protesters. But that weekend, before Trump's rant, there were six guys who knelt. Six. The next weekend, there were more than 200 who either knelt or stayed in the locker room. And in Baltimore, they made a decision that they were going to respond as a team. Before the anthem began, they all knelt and held hands. And the fans booed them mercilessly. And I'm sure you guys were in the stadium, but they were not kneeling during the anthem.
What's amazing about that day is I was in Wembley all week, and it was one of the worst weeks ever, right? They got their ass kicked. I had sponsors canceling me. I had one place saying, we'll never have players in here again. Like, all of that was going on. And that day, I ran into Dick Cass. And I know you know the back tunnel down to the press – from the press box down to the locker room. I was on that back area. It's all gray and industrial. And I ran into Dick Cass 15 minutes before kickoff. And it was a bad week around there, right? They had a lot of military sponsors that had club level seats, the whole Northrop Grumman machine, all of that was going on. And Dick said, Nestor, we're going to do a great thing today. Wait till you see what we're going to do. We thought this up and we're attacking this and they're going to see what we're going to do. And then 15 minutes later, I was in my seat with 38,000 people booing all of it. And I thought to myself, oh, my God, did the people not hear this message?
Yeah. And you know, Kevin Byrne wrote the PR guy forever for the Ravens until last year, a message, like you said, saying, let's all be Americans. Let's all put aside our differences, blah, 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 blah. But when the fans saw the players kneeling, they went nuts, even though it was not during the anthem. I was in NFL stadiums a lot that year, as you know, Nestor, because I was working on my quarterback book. So I was all over the country, and it was the same thing every week. Black guys kneeling, white people booing. And my thought was, boy, are we divided racially right now, that was the inspiration for the book. But when I went to see John Thompson, who became a very good friend after he retired and after we stopped fighting all the time. And I said, I want to do a book about race in sports. And John said to me, you might as well try to explain the Holy Trinity.
Right.
And then he said, but that's why you have to do the book. And so I went from there. And what I found in researching it was, My initial thought was, why are we so polarized? That's what I wanted to find out. Well, I realized that saying we're polarized racially is like saying tomorrow's Friday. And what I did find is in 2021, after everything that's happened, I started researching the book before George Floyd. But even after George Floyd, after all that's gone on, Black Lives Matter and all these things, it's still much harder in 2021 to be black than to be white in this country. And I heard chapter and verse from people like Tommy Smith, John Carlos, Marlon Briscoe, James Harris, Tony Dungy, Mike Tomlin, John Thompson, who I managed to sit down with before he died, you know, Nolan Richardson, all the important black coaches, Willie Randolph, who managed the Mets really well for 4 years and then never got another chance as a manager. And you guys know how baseball managers get recycled.
John, you talk, I'm going to interrupt just for a second, sure, because I think you talk in the book, at least I've looked at some excerpts, and I had no idea. Lovie Smith got fired after he was 10-6.
10-6.
And had been to a Super Bowl.
John, I want to jump
went to
on
a Super Bowl with Rex Grossman as his quarterback.
And did okay in that Super Bowl for a while after the kickoff. I was there in the ring until Prince sang and screwed it all up. But I want to bring this up because I was in the Midwest this week. And I can be a little flippant, as you're well aware. And I was in an Uber wearing my Ravens mask with a guy, a driver who had a Chiefs mask. And we were talking about things. And he said to me, you know, saw my name and lived in Vegas and sort of knew who I was from being syndicated. He said to me, why doesn't Eric Bieniemy have a job? And I said, well, I've gone to about 15 owners meetings. They're racists. And yeah, I don't have any problem saying that. And because Marvin Lewis is my friend, Marvin Lewis fixed the Cincinnati Bengals for 16 years and can't get his phone to ring. And was one of the best human beings I know.
That's right.
And still wants to work. Wants to work, yep, so much that he gets up every day out in Scottsdale and drives in, puts his feet up on Herm Edwards' desk. I'm appalled by all of it, but the fact that the NFL has not shown the kind of leadership that the fact that Goodell would take one stance 1 year and the next year has his cookies on and hot chocolate and they're running ads about this after, yeah, I stood next to him in that press box and said, are you blackballing Colin Kaepernick? And he looked at me like, oh, we're not blackballing anyone. Right. And I'm thinking, well, what the hell do you call it 5 years later? What are we going to, yeah, call it now?
Well, you bring up a lot of important points. I interviewed both Marvin Lewis and Eric Bieniemy for this book. Goodell refused to be interviewed. He was the only commissioner who turned me down. But Tony Dungy, who's one of the nicest men on the planet, makes the point that every time he brings the issues up that you're talking about, Nestor, people start screaming at him, why do you have to make race an issue? Well, the answer is because race is an issue.
Right.
And
right,
you're right about the owners. I mean,
and this is where the gaslighting begins. The gaslighting begins right then. That you're going to
exactly
make it
right
about what it's not really about.
Bieniemy has been interviewed 11 times. 11 times. But he said several of the interviews he knew were just for the Rooney Rule. On a couple of occasions, he thought he had a chance to get the job. And of course, he hasn't. And people just look around and go, how is that possible? How is it possible that all these 35-year-old white guys, who in some cases have never been coordinators, or Joe Judge was a special teams coordinator. Of course, so was John Harbaugh, and he's been a great coach. But the best example, I think, Nestor, might be Jim Caldwell. Jim Caldwell took over the Lions when they had had one winning season in 25 years. He went 11-5. He went 9-7. He went 9-7. And 1 year he went 7-9. He was 38-24. 36 and 28. Best record for a Lions coach since Buddy Parker in the 50s. And he gets fired. He gets fired, and they bring in Matt Patricia, who is a complete and utter disaster. Complete and utter disaster.
Dan Campbell's going to fix things. Trust me. I saw that last week.
I'm not sure I'd go along with that one. But but the point is, Tony Dungy told me he watched Mrs. Ford's press conference when they fired Caldwell, and she said, the team is better, the culture is better, the city is better, Jim's a great guy, we're firing him. What?
No, one plus one equals three.
Jim hasn't been able to get a sniff at a head coaching job since then either, even though what he did in Detroit was borderline miraculous.
John Feinstein is our guest. He writes books and does things. Go ahead, Don.
I was just going to say, I mean, I can't wait to read the book. I said read some excerpts. What you're going to tell this story at the end of the book? Can you give us a spoiler alert? Do you have any suggestions? Do you see a future? Do you see a way out of this? What conclusions do you draw? And again, the name of the book is Raise a Fist, Take a Knee. It comes out November 16th. What conclusions do you draw, John?
Well, some of it comes from a guy named Richard Lapchick, who has become in the last 30 years, really, the scorekeeper for both race and gender in terms of hires in sports. He puts out a report every year on what each league did.
He's the original watchdog, literally, right?
What? Yeah.
He's the original watchdog. Yeah,
he is. He dating back to the 1980s. And what he said to me, and I agree with him, is ultimately what began with Black Lives Matter must continue, in the sense that the athletes have to drive this bus. You know, old white guys like us aren't going to change things. We're really not going to be around when things seriously change. But the athletes, guys like LeBron James and others who have spoken up and gotten attacked for it, of course, they have to drive the bus. They have to say no. I mean, what happened after the shooting in Wisconsin of Jacob Blake in August of 2020, which was, you remember, a couple months after the George Floyd murder, when every sport shut down for 2 days in protest. Hockey and basketball shut down their playoffs. Baseball shut down during the regular season. Football camps were shut in most places. A tennis tournament shut down. The only sport, no surprise, that didn't do anything was golf. And actually, Jay Monahan, the commissioner, told me that in retrospect, it was a mistake. They should have shut down too. Those are the kind of things when the athletes stand up and say, no, we're not accepting this anymore. That's how we'll see some progress. And the other thing, we really have to go back, and this will sound corny, but I'll say it anyway. George Raveling, the basketball coach, who I'm sure you guys know of, he has the notes from Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. He was a bodyguard for Martin Luther King that day. He was standing right behind him when he gave that speech.
Wow.
On the mall. And Dr. King walked off the podium and he left his typed notes behind. And George picked them up and said, Dr. King, do you want these? He said, no, you can keep them. And George still has them. He's been offered as much as $3 million for them. But the point that George made to me, and I agree with him, is the dream that Dr. King spoke about that day, that dream still lives. And we've made progress. There's no question we made progress. That dream still lives, but we haven't lived the dream yet. We still have a ways to go to get to it.
John, I can't wait to read the book. And, you know, for you to take this one on, you mentioned something about and Kareem stood up this week and talked about vaccinations, right, leadership, and challenged athletes to lead. The one thing we'll always know in this society is when they do, there's going to come that other pushback, right? That always, the Rush Limbaugh side.
And I know, Nestor, the right wing's going to attack me for this book. And they're going to say, you're creating racial issues, like they say to Tony Dungy, where there are none. And one last thing, because I know we got to go, but Richard Lapchick wrote a book in the mid-1980s on his experiences working against apartheid and dealing with racism. At one point, two people broke into his office and carved the N-word, into his stomach. He was in the hospital for 4 days. He wrote a book about it, and a guy named Jeremiah Tax reviewed it in Sports Illustrated and called Lapchick an ideologue and said, oh no, racism, we're good with racism. We've fixed it. Well, that was 1984. Well, we're 37 years later. We still aren't close to fixing it. And I understand my agent did not want me to do this book because she knew I was going to get, and I'm going to get attacked, and it's fine. I look at it as a badge of honor.
Absolutely.
You know, five publishers turned the book down, I think, because they were afraid of it. And that's fine, too. Little Brown is publishing it. And thank goodness for my longtime editor and friend, Michael Peach. And I'm proud of the book. I'm proud that I did it. And I'm proud of the reporting that's in the book. I think there are a lot of fascinating stories in it.
Well, we can't wait to read. Have you read your buddy Woodward's? I know you guys together. Read Peril?
I've read Peril. It's classic Bob. I mean, he just gets stuff that nobody else gets. And, you know, that the memo, I don't know if you guys have read about this in the papers because it's really been underplayed, but the memo that one of Trump's lawyers wrote on how Pence could overturn the election on January 6th, and it was a six-step process.
You can't go to prison for that in this country. I don't know have laws.
No, but I mean, Bob got that memo, which nobody had gotten. And the thing about Bob, I won't go on too long here, but the thing about Bob.
Are you going to do your impression?
Okay. Yeah. He's a fabulous reporter. he's absolutely wonderful. But the thing about Bob is he's 78 years old He's the greatest reporter ever, as far as I'm concerned. And I think most people would agree. And he's still trying to get better.
Well, John, what makes him, what makes, I had dinner with friends the other night, and we continue to be amazed. What is his magic sauce that gets people to sit down and totally open up to him? And I'll give Bob Costas some credit, too. He co-authored the book. But what's the magic sauce that makes people sit down with Woodward and bare their soul?
You know, I've asked him that question because I try to get people to bare their souls. I think some of it is he's so low-key. He's soft-spoken. He doesn't come across as a guy. He's not aggressive. He doesn't get in your face and say, tell me this. But the thing is, what amazes me is everybody knows who Bob Woodward is. It's not like he can sneak up on you.
Right.
Oh, yeah, you're Bob Woodward. I never heard of you. but I also think that if you look back to all the years, even going back to All the President's Men, when Nixon's people were constantly accusing he and Carl of, you know, making stuff up, very, very few people have ever accused Bob of being unfair. He's down the middle. He doesn't inject his opinions into his books. He reports. He tells you, this is what was said. This is what I learned. And the story, I'll leave you with this. The story that sums Bob up is when he wrote his book on the CIA, you might remember when it came out, he had all these quotes from, I think it was Richard Helms, who was the head of the CIA at the time. I might have the name wrong, but the guy had just died. And everybody came out and said, there's no way he said any of that. No way. And Bob went on Nightline with his wife. And she said, oh, there's no way my husband would talk to Bob Woodward like that. There's no way he would spend that kind of time with Bob Woodward. And Bob very softly said, now, Mrs. It wasn't Helms. It was somebody else. But you must remember those Saturday mornings when I came and sat with your husband in the basement and you so nicely brought us roast beef sandwiches at lunchtime. And finally she goes, well, maybe a couple times.
John, we appreciate you, man. Good luck with the book when it comes out in a couple of weeks. And I hope to run into you at some UMBC games here this year, right?
I will be there. I'm going to do the games again this year. I'm really looking forward to it. We only had 7 home games last year, but now it'll be a full slate again. And
well, Freeman's got more time. He can sit in and do color with you guys now.
If Freeman was available to do color, they wouldn't need me, Nestor. Trust me. Whenever I spoke for Ryan at the preseason banquet, I would always go after Freeman. And I go, are you kidding? I have to follow this guy?
Yeah. I said that so many times over the years. I'd look at the agenda and I'd say, really? Yeah. Really? I'm speaking after Freeman?
You know what we should do? We should have a Feinstein and Freeman over to State Fair for a retirement.
I'd do that in a heartbeat.
We should do a crab cake. We should definitely do that. John, love you. Appreciate you. Thank you very much for the time and all the great stuff on Ryder Cup and golf, too. We appreciate it.
Hope to talk to you when the book comes out.
John Feinstein joining us here. We will, of course, be promoting his book. You can find John at J. Feinstein Books out on Twitter. And, you know, anywhere he feels like writing and you find him, you can find him here in the state of Maryland, if not at UMBC. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, our Wise Conversations brought to you by our friends at Wise Markets. I am Nestor. We are WNST AM 1570. Towson, Baltimore. We never stop talking. Baltimore, positive.